All right. Hello, everyone.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back
to the Push Podcast. My name is Sydney. I'm a labor and delivery nurse and online content creator, birth educator. And this is my cousin, Megan.
I'm Dr. Megan. I'm an OBGYN clinical researcher and a mom myself.
Yeah, new mama. So today we are talking all about miscarriages. So this is for the Pregnancy and Infant Loss Remembrance Day. That is today, mm-hmm. October 15th. So this is a little trigger warning for everyone. If this is not a topic that you feel comfortable listening to right now, depending on what you're going through or what you have recently gone through, that is completely okay. We have lots of other episodes that might pique your interest. So if you need to skip this one, we totally get it.
Yeah. Feel free to scroll this week if this is not a space that you feel like you can be comfortable in at this point.
Yeah. But for those of you who are interested in hearing more about miscarriages, today we're going to be talking about what a miscarriage actually is, the different types of miscarriages, myths, and misconceptions. We're also going to talk about diagnosis and management of miscarriages, and then the emotional and social dimensions that go hand in hand with pregnancy loss as well. And then just like red flags, when to seek help, when to go to the doctor's office, and stuff like that.
So, and you know what? I think the social emotional, which we'll get into some of the studies around in a little bit more detail later, but that really is what has driven us to choose this as a topic and to so intentionally talk about miscarriage in general, because it's something that so many women still don't realize is common, that lots of other parents that you know and people in your lives have likely experienced.
Yeah,
I think because for a long time, we really suffered in silence and in the darkness with respect to especially early pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
But it is something that needs to be brought out into the light so that we can, number one, understand and study it and take care of patients better in those circumstances, but also so that people feel less alone when they are going through it.
Exactly. Because a lot of times, like, especially historically, people have always said, you know, you don't announce your pregnancy until you're, you know, well over that first trimester into that 12, 13 week mark. And that's okay if that's what feels right for you, but it's also okay if you want to announce your pregnancy the second you pee on a stick and see that it's positive.
Yeah.
There's no harm or shame in doing that as well. And I think having these conversations and seeing people share their experiences online allows people to feel more comfortable to share that they also did experience miscarriage because one in four women or one in four pregnancies end in miscarriage, which is a statistic that I think is actually quite high. Like think of four friends that you have.
Exactly.
One out of the four friends you have experienced miscarriage,
and honestly,
or will.
The rate is probably higher, right?
Yeah.
You know, I have a couple of friends and colleagues who navigated this in a little bit of a different way when they were in early pregnancy. Mm. I myself didn't announce my pregnancy for quite some time, but that had nothing to do with miscarriage rates necessarily. It was more circumstantial. I had a colleague I remember when we were quite a bit younger who was pregnant, and she told sort of her group of close friends, I think at the time, and close colleagues, that she was pregnant very early on. I think I knew at like 6 weeks.
Wow.
And she said something that really stuck with me and that I carried forward into my pregnancy, which is that she said, you know what? I would want you to know, I would need your support if this doesn't progress to a full-term baby.
Exactly.
And so she kind of had the mindset of like, I'm going to tell everyone in my life that I would want to gather around me if this didn't go the way that I'm hoping it goes.
Yeah.
And then I had another colleague who very similarly said, she was like, you know what? I'm an OBGYN. She told everybody very early on. Mm-hmm. She like announced it widely because she said, if this ends in miscarriage, obviously she would be upset. Mm-hmm. But she said, I want people and my patients, like I want to be the example for talking about this out loud, right?
Yeah.
And living the experience that many pregnancies don't end in a full-term healthy baby.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I respect all of those strategies, anyone's strategy, but I just say I found that very admirable to take on as an individual.
Yeah. That's amazing. Cause I think sometimes the silence can make people feel more alone in this.
Yeah.
It's similar to how, you know, people are starting to talk more nowadays about mental illness and how that's affecting everyone. And it's similar kind of topic that is just these things need to be talked about so that when you're experiencing it, when you're going through it, you don't feel alone and that you have people around you who can support you.
So
we're gonna talk all about that today. But there's your friendly trigger warning if you need to keep going and go on to our next episode.
You can join us next week. No worries at all from our end.
Yeah.
So listen, let's get into it. What is a miscarriage, right? Because I think we talk about miscarriage in a lot of different ways. And let me say as well, like pregnancy loss in general, I feel like miscarriage sometimes feels like a little bit of a gentle term. And it is something that we often use colloquially. It's not necessarily the medical term for what happens. But I think as I've sat and prepared for this episode and thought about it a little bit, I almost feel like we should perhaps take issue with the term in and of itself, because miscarriage kind of puts the onus back on the pregnant person, right? As if somehow there was something that they missed or didn't do or did poorly that resulted in not being able to carry the pregnancy, which, as we'll discuss, couldn't be further from the truth for most miscarriages.
It's so hard. Like most people do take on that blame.
So for sake of ease within this episode, we will use the term miscarriage because it is used most commonly, I think, socially. But know as well that I think perhaps we should take, like, if the term doesn't sit right with you, that is really valid. And and I wonder if maybe we should be re-examining kind of what kind of thoughts, what assumptions that evokes in us, that that word itself.
Yeah, I guess maybe pregnancy loss is maybe a little bit more fitting. I don't know. Maybe let us know in the comments.
Let us know what you think is right and how these words make you feel. In any case, miscarriage is typically defined as a pregnancy loss before 20 weeks. So pregnancies are 40 weeks commonly in duration. So basically the first half of pregnancy. And there's a few different categories that we often hear denoted, things like a chemical pregnancy, a clinical miscarriage, and then stillbirth as well. So really briefly, chemical pregnancies refer to very early losses. And this often occurs before someone even realizes they're pregnant. But typically, this is detected only by a pregnancy test that later turns negative. So a positive pregnancy test for which we're never able to confirm on ultrasound or which unfortunately passes before sonographic confirmation can take place. So very early. And these are very common. And oftentimes, honestly, as an OBGYN, I'm not the person that sees these. It's within the realm of family practice, right? Because by the, like, they often have passed before they ever get to me. A clinical miscarriage is the loss that occurs after a pregnancy has been seen on ultrasound or confirmed in clinic. And then a stillbirth is typically really referred to a pregnancy loss within second trimester, which occurs, a pregnancy loss which occurs on or after 20 weeks. So after that 20 week mark.
And then just for clarity for this month, because it is pregnancy pregnancy loss and infant loss awareness month. Infant loss would be after the baby is born then. So stillbirth is prior to
delivery.
Being delivered.
And for, just because these are such large topics, today we're really talking about first trimester and second trimester, particularly early second trimester losses. So those less than 20 week losses. But that's not to say that later term losses are not obviously also hugely traumatic and a worthy topic to discuss as well.
Absolutely. Again, let us know if that's something you'd be interested in. I think that that is just equally as important to talk about and something that we can maybe make a future episode on as well.
So the reasons why pregnancy loss occurs really depend on individual physiology and anatomy. So on the person themselves, on the genetics of that pregnancy. But also on circumstance, right? So approximately 80% of miscarriages occur within the first trimester. The highest risk period for miscarriage is also the earliest weeks of pregnancy. And that's part of why the number is hard to calculate, because so many losses occur potentially before someone even realizes that they're pregnant.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
That risk declines substantially as gestational age advances within the first trimester. So once cardiac activity has been seen on ultrasound, the highest risk chance for loss is around the 6-week mark. And then slowly as you approach 12 to 13 weeks, that loss, the chance of loss decreases every week. Mm. And this is for asymptomatic women who, again, have confirmed to have a viable pregnancy. So an embryo inside the uterus with a heartbeat.
Right.
The vast majority of early losses are due to chromosomal anomalies, and the majority of these present before 10 weeks of gestation.
Okay.
Again, risk of miscarriage is often also influenced by things like pregnancy history and maternal and paternal history. Mm-hmm. But the temporal pattern, regardless of how we cut it, remains pretty consistent in that the first trimester, especially the first 8 to 10 weeks or so, is the period of greatest vulnerability. So the most common causes, as I mentioned, are chromosomal anomalies. And this is particularly true for aneuploidies, such as trisomies, right? So things like trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome, as well as trisomy 18 and 13.
Okay.
Monosomy X or Turner syndrome. So that's where someone just has one X chromosome. I'm sure if we remember back to like high school genetics, most female-bodied people have XX chromosomes. Most male-bodied people have XY chromosomes. Although, spoiler alert, that's not universally true by any means. There is much room for differences in chromosomal makeup, both with respect to like what someone actually has as their chromosomes and with respect to how that presents phenotypically or on the outside. But that is beyond the scope of today. These genetic defects actually account for 50 to 70% of first trimester losses. Wow. So again, the vast majority of first trimester losses are caused by chromosomal anomalies that occur very early on in conception, at the earliest days of conception. So not anything that anybody can influence in any one way or the other.
Yeah. So not, you know, drinking alcohol before you found out you were pregnant. That's most likely not the, not what caused your miscarriage. And we will go into all of those things in a little bit. Okay. So Megan, what makes up that additional 30% then?
So other less common causes, but established causes include things like maternal clotting disorders. Some of the common ones would be factor V Leiden or antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. Also endocrine dysfunction, so things like thyroid abnormalities or diabetes. Uterine anatomical abnormalities, so things like septate uteri. Or environmental exposures or lifestyle factors, things like high alcohol consumption before you find out you're pregnant can contribute, as well as certain infections can sometimes be a prompter. But again, the rest of this kind of falls into these much smaller percentages, contributing to the overall picture of miscarriage.
Okay, so don't freak out if you have had a couple drinks before you even knew you were pregnant. Most likely that is not going to impact your chance of having a miscarriage.
Exactly. The common counseling really is that in the time before you find, in the time before you miss a period, outside of obviously people who have had like very irregular periods or for whom that time might extend far longer than the first, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. Typically the major risk at that time is miscarriage. If you, with excess alcohol consumption, it's not necessarily of like fetal alcohol spectrum. That happens with sustained alcohol use or high volume alcohol use later on in pregnancy.
And I mean, you can't be mad at yourself for doing something when you didn't know you were pregnant. Like you literally have zero control over that.
If you don't know, you don't know.
Right? What are you going to do? I mean, as soon as you find out you're pregnant, if you stop drinking and you do all of the proper things,
we tell patients
you're supposed
not
to,
to worry.
Don't worry.
Do not worry about what happened in that first time or in that first time before you found out you were pregnant.
Yeah. And then that kind of leads into some of the myths and misconceptions that I want to talk about. One of the first ones being that stress causes a miscarriage. Is that true?
So sort of true, but only really, but not true so much in the greater context, right?
Okay.
So when we do try to isolate maternal stress as a risk factor, we have found that there is some evidence to suggest it does carry with it a slightly higher risk of miscarriage than the baseline risk, right? But And this association does persist even when we account for different types of stress and exposures and things like that. Now, okay. I will say stress can be inherently difficult to measure in a study, right? Because yeah. our experiences of stress, our coping strategies for stress,
everyone's so different,
are so, so, so vast, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing to reframe yeah. studies like that with respect to, you know, adapting it to our daily lives
yeah.
is that stress doesn't directly cause chromosomal anomalies, right?
No, not
stress
at all.
Does not cause uterine structural issues. Mm-mm. Stress doesn't give you factor V Leiden or antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. Yeah. So the amount of miscarriages that could be impacted by increased stress is really a small fraction of the total number of miscarriages that occur.
Okay.
So that is why we counsel patients that like your stress did not cause your miscarriage.
Yeah.
It's not that physiologic stress can't have an impact on things like implantation and sustaining an early pregnancy,
okay.
but it's rather that the proportion of miscarriages that would even be susceptible to that okay. is so, so, so much smaller than what is much more likely to have been the cause of someone's miscarriage, which ultimately comes back to things like chromosomal anomalies.
Gotcha.
Like really what we're talking about is that perhaps stress can make you a little bit more vulnerable to something like an infection,
okay.
right?
True.
Then, or, you know, may exacerbate the impact of an environmental toxin like alcohol, for instance,
okay.
as opposed to like, it's not going to cause some of these much more common issues.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I feel like it's hard sometimes to be honest about the data, but also be reassuring. And that I yeah. think is really what comes to the root of it is that we're talking about a very small increase from baseline, like a very small difference between the stressed and the non-stressed group. Mm-hmm. And even then, the impact of that would only be on a very small percentage of the causes of miscarriage.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? At the end of the day, stressing about being stressed about having mm-hmm. a miscarriage, like it's that's not going to help anything.
Yeah.
If you are an anxious person and you have the resources to go see a therapist and potentially, yeah. you know, get that help before you start yeah. trying to conceive, great, do it. But at the end of the day, you know, if something happens in your life and you're more stressed than usual and you can't control yeah. that, what are you going to do? Right? Like you're going to do what you can. And the likely cause of your miscarriage has nothing to do with your slight increase in stress. Right? So
the truth is that even later in pregnancy, I'm far more concerned with the impact of stress on maternal mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
Than I would be about the remote chance of a miscarriage in first trimester that would really and truly be attributed to an increased stress level.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that you deserve to enjoy your pregnancy in as yeah. much as you're able to, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You deserve to be, you know, engaging in this process and, mm-hmm. and able to look towards the future with a lot of excitement and as opposed to feeling weighed down by things like stress and anxiety. So
yeah.
that's really, as a provider, that's where my mind goes when my patients are under a lot of stress. It's more mm-hmm. on the psychosocial impact of that on them than it yeah. is about like remote chance of miscarriage in first trimester.
Right, right. And mm-hmm. it's hard because I think someone who experiences lots of mm-hmm. miscarriages or repetitive, what is that called?
Recurrent miscarriage.
That's the yeah. word. Mm-hmm. Recurrent miscarriage. With every subsequent pregnancy, I feel like you probably start to get even more stressed, right? Because mm-hmm. you're like, oh, is this one going to stay? Am I yeah. going to have another miscarriage? And you almost, it starts that cycle, which can yeah. be really challenging too and,
yeah.
and hard to deal with. So yeah, stress is a hard one, but one of the more, I guess, common ones that I think a lot of people think is mm-hmm. that spotting always equals miscarriage.
Yeah. Spotting definitely does not always equal miscarriage. Spotting is pretty common, with about 20 to 25% of recognized pregnancies experiencing some sort of spotting in first trimester, normal, some yeah. sort of bleeding.
Yeah.
Now, when we look at overall numbers, it does look like when people experience bleeding in first trimester,
yeah.
something like half of those overall will go on to have a miscarriage. Now, stay with me though, guys. Mm-hmm. Do not stress if you experience a little bit of bleeding in your miscarriage or in your pregnancy rather. Because the truth is that when we begin to divide out the groups a little bit further,
yeah.
that 50% shrinks for people who are experiencing kind of very small amounts and little bits of bleeding.
Okay.
So basically the risk is highly dependent on the characteristics of bleeding.
Right.
Right. So light or brief spotting is really accompanied by a much lower risk of miscarriage, while heavy bleeding, especially associated with a lot of cramping and pain, is associated with a more substantially increased risk of miscarriage. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where that concern comes from.
Okay.
Importantly as well, if ultrasound has already demonstrated an intrauterine pregnancy with a normal fetal heart rate and growth, the risk of miscarriage is not necessarily always significantly impacted by the presence of bleeding, right?
Yeah.
The risk of miscarriage is highest when bleeding is also accompanied by abnormal ultrasound findings or the absence of fetal cardiac activity.
Right.
So again, these things don't exist in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. It's impossible to assess anyone's individual risk of miscarriage at any one point because there are a ton of different factors that may weigh into how likely or unlikely it is to occur.
Yeah.
But I would say I do have a lot of patients who experience a small amount of spotting, and I would hope that these kind of statistics or these kind of facts lend a little bit more relief and comfort to people continuing through the first trimester in that particular circumstance.
Yeah. Okay, and then the third myth is that miscarriage is rare.
You know, we've kind of alluded to this already or talked about this, but
it's not.
Miscarriage occurs in 15 to 25% of known pregnancies. And that's just the known pregnancies, right?
Yeah.
That rate likely is much higher if we account for all of the pregnancy or the miscarriages that occur before someone finds out that they're pregnant.
Right, like right? chemical pregnancies and stuff.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. And again, 80% of those occur in first trimester and about 70% of those are chromosomal anomalies. So again, that doesn't even, the amount of miscarriages that for which there was really no way that a person could impact it is even higher than 70%.
Yeah.
And when we look at overall population data, we find that at least 43% of women report having experienced at least one miscarriage. And again, I would hazard a guess that that number is actually higher than that.
Yeah.
So this is in fact approaching, this is super common and probably approaches a majority of women having experienced at least one miscarriage at some point in their lives.
Yeah. So now moving on to the different types of miscarriage, because I think that sometimes all the medical definitions and language that's used can be really confusing and overwhelming.
Yeah.
And like, even to me, who's someone who works in this area, I still find it to be challenging to understand. So let's break it down a little bit for our listeners so that they can have a better understanding of it.
Absolutely. So I'm going to go through all the different types of miscarriage. Mm-hmm. But something I want to mention as well is that especially if people are going through this or have gone through this and are reading their charts, for instance, to try and figure out exactly what happened.
Yeah.
The medical term for a miscarriage is an abortion.
Yes. Yep.
And I know that that term sits really heavily with people, especially because abortion is most commonly used to denote a therapeutic abortion, right? Yeah. Or an abortion, a termination of pregnancy that occurs because someone has electively decided to terminate their pregnancy.
Yep.
And again, this is to be so clear from the get-go, this is a space where we feel very strongly that that human rights and maternal rights include termination of pregnancy.
Yep.
We will tolerate no discussion otherwise in the comments.
Nope. Blocked.
But I do think in the context of miscarriage, that term can feel even weightier and somehow accusatory.
Yes.
So if you do see abortion in your notes, know that it's not because somebody thinks that you wanted this or did something to try and prompt this. It's just kind of historic medical language to denote any loss of pregnancy in the first trimester.
That's so true. When I first started working on labor and delivery and I was reading through patient charts and I saw spontaneous abortion, like that's usually what we chart if you've had.
And it just means miscarriage.
It just means a miscarriage. And and that, when I was learning that, I got very confused because I was like, oh, why do they call it that? But it's just, that's what the language is. So as you said, don't freak out. It wasn't something that was done without your consent. It's just the
medical. And no judgment was passed about the fact that you're experiencing this.
Yes, exactly. And same thing goes for if it was a therapeutic abortion. there's also no judgment passed for that.
No,
as well.
No.
When we're looking through charts, but that's a great point to make that very clear. Yeah.
So with respect to miscarriage, there are, again, a few different kinds and terms that we can use, and we'll just briefly go through them. Mm-hmm. So threatened miscarriage typically refers to vaginal bleeding in early pregnancy, while a cervix is still closed and the pregnancy is still viable on ultrasound. Mm-hmm. So it's a warning sign that potentially a miscarriage could occur, but it certainly doesn't always progress to miscarriage.
Yeah.
Now, an inevitable miscarriage is one where bleeding and cramping is occurring with an open cervix. So that typically is not a process that can be stopped, and it does denote that pregnancy loss is underway. Mm. An incomplete miscarriage is one where some pregnancy tissue has passed, but not all. The cervix is typically open in this context, and bleeding and cramping may continue. Mm-hmm. A complete miscarriage is one where all of the pregnancy tissue has passed, the uterus is empty, and bleeding and cramping has resolved. Mm. A missed miscarriage is one where the embryo or the fetus has stopped developing. Okay. However, your body or the person's body hasn't recognized the loss yet. And so this is often discovered on ultrasound, typically incidentally, as opposed to someone coming into the emergency department because they're experiencing symptoms that could be consistent with a miscarriage.
Right.
Now, there's one other one that I wanted to add here because I see this sometimes online and some confusion about this is an anembryonic pregnancy or a blighted ovum. Is one of the other things that you might see denoted. And basically what this means is that the pregnancy sac develops, but an embryo never forms or else stops developing at a very, very early stage. It's a type of missed miscarriage that, again, is usually diagnosed on ultrasound, but it is not one that would progress into a pregnancy otherwise.
Okay.
Now, some important distinctions that I think can also sometimes get confusing is ectopic pregnancies, which refer to pregnancies that implant somewhere other than the lining of the uterus, okay? This is usually a fallopian tube, but can be in many different places. This would not be considered a miscarriage, but can be a life-threatening complication. And again, ectopic pregnancies, this is a like overarching statement. Please talk to your provider if you're experiencing one. As somebody who deals with a lot of rare ectopic pregnancies as part of my subspecialty, I certainly know there's exceptions to this rule. But typically, ectopic pregnancies do not implant in places where they could grow into a healthy pregnancy. And they, again, can be life-threatening, so usually require either medical or surgical management. The last one as well is a molar pregnancy. So this is a rare condition where basically abnormal placental tissue grows instead of a normal pregnancy. Now, there's complete moles and partial moles, and sometimes a pregnancy can kind of grow alongside of it, but certainly it can resemble miscarriage, requires appropriate management with an OBGYN team. Recurrent miscarriage as well is a term that is often tossed around and has a couple of different definitions depending on whether we're using research statistics or researched clinical definitions, research definitions or clinical definitions. And depending on what guideline you're using. But basically it's defined as two or more consecutive pregnancy losses in some guidelines and three or more in others. It's less common than having an isolated miscarriage and typically prompts investigation with reproductive endocrinology or otherwise known as the infertility teams or fertility groups.
And talking back or going back to the missed miscarriages quickly, I just want to, because I find that one hard when people share their stories online. I've seen a lot of people say, well, I wish they did my first trimester ultrasound sooner. I see that a lot. How do you navigate that?
You know, it's hard to know. I certainly can appreciate feeling as though you would have liked to know about it earlier. Certainly with respect to these kinds of miscarriages, in the vast majority of cases, there's nothing that a medical team could have done to prevent it. And so I say that not to excuse when we find out about these things late, but rather I hope to alleviate some of the what ifs from people about, could I have done something to allow this pregnancy to continue? Again, we go back to 70% of miscarriages are chromosomal anomalies, and a good proportion of the other 30% are also caused by things that are outside of anyone's control.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Yep. That makes sense.
But I think that does lead into another good topic, or another like a kind of subsequent topic, which is how do we diagnose these, right? And what do we do with the information? Because certainly what I see a lot of online is stories of people who were told they were likely going to have a miscarriage, that they were having a missed miscarriage or a non-viable pregnancy. So a pregnancy where the embryo was not growing, only to find out later in a week or two that the pregnancy was growing, right?
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of patients that then really feel strongly that they want a subsequent ultrasound. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem ordering that for what it's worth. If for no other reason than to provide satisfy that question and provide peace of mind moving forward, as long as the pregnant person is well, right? As long as I'm not worried about infection or other complications.
Yeah.
But I do think, without going into all of the details, we do fortunately and unfortunately have pretty good sonographic criteria for which we can diagnose a non-viable pregnancy on one ultrasound.
Okay.
So if you were sitting here thinking, oh my God, I only had one ultrasound, and what would have happened if I had another one, you know, 7 to 10 days later?
Yeah.
It's obviously, I can't review everybody's medical charts or anything like that, but often what happens when we diagnose it at one is that it meets the diagnostic criteria at that first ultrasound.
Okay.
So things like a crown rump length, so the length of the embryo that is greater than 7 millimeters with no heartbeat, is diagnostic of a pregnancy that is non-viable, right? Okay. That is not going to grow, because at that size, we certainly should see a heartbeat. And we have information over, you know, thousands and thousands of ultrasounds that allows us to tell this with confidence.
Okay.
However, a crown rump length less than 7 millimeters and no heartbeat is suspicious for, but not diagnostic of pregnancy that is not viable. And so that gray area is typically where providers will recommend returning for another scan.
Right.
Because then if at a 7 to 10 day scan, we still have no heartbeat, we still don't have a pregnancy that has grown in that time,
then they know.
Then typically we are able to diagnose it at that second scan. And there's other criteria as well that we look at. That's just literally one feature that we would compare between the two.
Yeah.
So I bring that up mostly to say, you know, that we can diagnose it with one ultrasound. Yeah. I think it is very reasonable to feel that you want the second ultrasound, even if we meet those diagnostic criteria, for peace of mind. Yep. But that's the why. That's why it's offered in some cases, or recommended in some cases, and not in others, from the provider side of things.
I want to recognize too that those 7 to 10 days must feel
awful. Awful. Like,
there's just nothing you can do or say to cope through that process.
Yeah.
Like that is, ugh, like just like a waiting game of just trying to come to terms with knowing that potentially your pregnancy is over, and then, but the slight bit of hope that maybe it is. And that's why, again, you said you're okay with, with doing a second ultrasound.
Yeah.
If that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To provide some peace of mind.
Yeah. You know, I have lots of, there's so much room in this for everyone's experiences and for people to find different parts of this hard or hardest. But I know that I've had a lot of patients tell me that for them, the waiting period in many cases was the hardest time, because the not knowing in some in some cases was more difficult than beginning the grieving process for the pregnancy or going through the physical process of a miscarriage.
Yeah. But like you said, it's good to know that majority of miscarriages can be diagnosed with one ultrasound, which is good.
It just depends on timing and circumstances, right?
Yeah.
But again, the thing we wanted to get around a little bit is like why a second ultrasound is not automatically ordered in all cases.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. Sorry, I was just going to say, now let's talk about like the management. So once it's diagnosed, then where do we go from there?
Yeah.
What happens?
So we have kind of three key categories of management options for miscarriage in the first trimester. The first one is expectant management. And so this is just a natural completion of the miscarriage. It is a bit unpredictable. It's hard for us to know when that would occur. And typically we see this for patients, like most of the time when we're talking about these three options kind of as equal pathways, is when people have experienced a missed miscarriage, right? Okay. So it refers to watchful waiting, right, for the pregnancy tissue to pass on its own. In the first trimester, the efficacy rates really vary, but, you know, 70 to 80% of these will pass on their own. Follow-up is usually required every 1 to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And usually we will give it kind of a maximum of 4 weeks to resolve on its own. And if it hasn't resolved on its own in that time frame, we usually recommend moving forward with either medical or surgical management, depending on the patient's circumstances.
Okay.
And the reason for that is, as time goes on, the risk of things like infection goes up, but also the risk of things like a really serious condition called disseminated intravascular coagulation, or DIC, which certainly goes up 4 weeks post-diagnosis of any pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
Any intrauterine pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
And basically what that is when serious conditions occur in our body, and it can be triggered by all sorts of different things, bad infections, cancers, major surgeries, but certainly pregnancy and pregnancy loss. Your body starts to try and use up all of your coagulation factors. So it makes tons and tons and tons of tiny little clots everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the first problem is we have tons and tons of tiny little clots that can be forming. Yeah. But the second part is much more concerning a lot of the times, in that we use up all of the coagulation factors. Yeah. So there's a bunch of ingredients your body needs to make a blood clot. Yeah. And once those are used up, it takes time for them to reaccumulate and to be redeveloped. And so that then puts people at risk of very severe bleeding that could be very difficult to control.
Yes.
And so that, especially in the context of a miscarriage, that certainly is a major concern.
Yeah.
Now that's rare, but it is part of the reason why we wouldn't necessarily just, you know, easily sign off on indefinite expectant management. The next would be medical management. Yeah. And usually what that means is misoprostol plus or minus, and more often these days plus, mifepristone. Mm-hmm. So mifepristone is a medication that basically blocks progesterone. And progesterone is required in order to sustain a pregnancy. So we typically give mifepristone first, and then that is followed by misoprostol, which is a prostaglandin that begins to induce uterine contractions. Mm-hmm. So the mifepristone works to start to block the progesterone, which softens the cervix, which starts to destabilize the pregnancy and endometrial lining, and prompt the uterus to be a little bit more sensitive to a prostaglandin, which is going to be then added to start uterine contractions to empty the pregnancy.
Yeah. Which I think this might sound a little bit confusing to some people who have maybe gone through an induction of labor, because these are similar medications and classes of medications that we do use for induction.
So misoprostol, a prostaglandin, is often used in induction of labor protocols, right? Yeah. In part because it does cause uterine contractions, right?
Yeah.
But as with many medications, they can be, they're not necessarily just for one thing. They, the way that they work on our, in our bodies can vary depending on the clinical circumstances, right? Yeah. So you're absolutely right that in later stages of pregnancy, meso can often be used in an induction protocol, but in this particular circumstance, it's used for evacuation of a pregnancy.
Yeah. And dosages and all that kind of stuff plays a role as well. But just to clarify, in case anyone's like, wait a second. I took that when I was pregnant for an induction. So
totally. Now, in the right circumstances, particularly in first trimester, mifigymeso, as we call it, I think it's the brand name maybe.
Yeah.
Is quite effective, and it can be, the efficacy rates range from 80 to above 90%, depending on the gestational age at which it's used. Mm. Side effects from it can include things like nausea. Lots of people experience nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain. When we look at the data, 99% of people describe abdominal pain, which is unfortunately part of the process of those uterine like contractions. And then fever. About 3% of people experience fever as well with misoprostol. Depending on those numbers, again, about 5 to 20% of people find that this is not enough to completely evacuate the pregnancy, and they require some form of additional treatment for the retained products of conception as they were. About 2% of people may have enough bleeding to require transfusion. But I think what is good is that in the absence of things like untreated bleeding or untreated infection, people, I think, worry a lot online, and there's been a lot of misinformation disseminated about, like, oh, this is a dangerous medication, you have a high risk of death. And again, outside of untreated complications, like bleeding, like infection and bleeding, the risk is negligible. And I don't actually think we even like have numbers to appropriately characterize it, at least in supervised, you know, settings, and even unsupervised settings, as long as there's appropriate access to care.
Right.
Now, with respect to surgical evacuation, that can vary as well, depending on the gestational ages with so many of these things. So some of the words that we use to describe that are DNC or dilatation and curettage, manual vacuum aspiration or electrical vacuum aspiration, or DNE or dilatation and evacuation. Mm-hmm. And again, these are all a little bit different options that may be recommended to or not depending on resources at the center that you're being seen or the gestational age.
Yeah.
The latter, DNE, is usually used for pregnancies above 13 weeks and may require some cervical preparation as well to soften and start to open the cervix before we're able to move forward with the DNE.
Okay.
We usually give antibiotics at the time of the OR. Most of the side effects are things like pain, again, from uterine contractions, as well as a feeling of faintness sometimes associated with manipulation of the cervix. And for this one, the main benefit is that there's a far smaller chance of having retained products, right? So about 1% with surgical evacuation, as well as a smaller risk of hemorrhage, about 0.3%. Now, there is a higher risk of having scarring within the uterus associated with this, and the numbers aren't really well calculated. We don't necessarily have a really well-established rate of uterine scarring, also called things like intrauterine adhesions or sometimes Asherman syndrome.
Okay.
The numbers can range anywhere from 1% to 30%, depending on the study you're looking at and what kind of protocols they use to diagnose it.
Yeah.
But I think what's important to keep in mind is that the clinically relevant rates of Asherman syndrome still appear to be quite low. And what that means is scarring within the uterus that causes problems, like difficulty getting pregnant in the future.
Okay.
So the rates of that are quite low.
Okay. And is that something that you would become more concerned with if they've had to have multiple DNCs?
Like, sure, as well as things like infection and bleeding associated, basically complicated surgical evacuations can increase the risk of having scarring within the uterus.
Okay.
And there are things that we can do both to help prevent scarring within the uterus for other uterine procedures, as well as to address it in the future if it does occur.
Yeah.
So it's not like the uterus scars and then there's nothing you can do about it. A lot of the time, there are management options that we can do to help release those scars in the future, although obviously nobody wants to have to go through something like that.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to ask was if patients are always put to sleep for these procedures, like are you sedated for the DNC or the DNE, or can you choose to be awake, or what's the thoughts there?
So I think it depends on the center.
Okay.
To be honest, you absolutely, in most centers, I would say, can have a general anesthetic for this.
Yeah.
Some people prefer to be awake. Mm-hmm. There certainly are regional anesthesia options, especially for people for whom a general anesthetic could be, you know, risky dangerous for their particular circumstances. Mm-hmm. We also can freeze the cervix, although that doesn't necessarily account for the uterine cramping part.
Yeah.
And certainly in many places in the world, even in Canada, for things like DNCs for therapeutic abortions, we may not always have access to an anesthetist, right? For that higher level analgesia. And so in many places, people are given pain medication through an IV, but are awake otherwise for them.
Okay.
So I would say there are, if going to sleep for the procedure is something that you don't want, there often are other options and ways that we can help you work through this. But for, you know, a DNC, I often find that most of my patients would prefer to have, you know, at least a conscious sedation for the process.
Yeah, something to help with pain management.
And yeah.
How does the cramping and the abdominal pain feel after the DNC? Does it continue for everyone, or it's done after you've had the DNC?
No, it varies for everybody, right? Oftentimes after any uterine procedure, people can have cramping. Mm-hmm. I often counsel for like a few days afterwards, sometimes up to a week, but it does take some time for the uterus to kind of contract. Sometimes it requires a little bit of shrinking back down to its pre-pregnancy size.
Yeah.
And so some intermittent cramping, even bleeding and spotting can be associated with that. But certainly if people were experiencing severe pain after a DNC, heavy bleeding or signs of infection, those would all be red flags to be seen again and reassessed for any complications of surgery.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that kind of goes over all the different types. And at the end of the day, it's kind of a decision that you need to make with your specific provider, though.
Yeah.
we can't make that decision for you, no, obviously.
This is like a brief primer of the options that may be available, yeah, but your particular circumstances and your center's resources are, yeah, going to dictate kind of what direction your providers may recommend for you.
Yeah.
But this at least, I hope, allows for people to have the language to discuss it and a bit of background information so that they have a sense of the structure and how what might be offered to them and why.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, can we talk about some of the complicated elements of, yeah, miscarriage? So second trimester loss. So this is that, yeah, 13 to 20 week gestation. Mm-hmm. So a little bit later on in your miscarriage. Pregnancy.
Yeah,
yeah.
So the causes for second trimester loss are also multifactorial.
Yeah.
They still include things like fetal chromosomal anomalies.
Yeah.
As well, though, as fetal structural malformations and genetic syndromes. Mm. But then they also start to include things like placental problems or cord pathology. So things like placental insufficiency, fetal growth restriction, and umbilical cord abnormalities, mm-hmm, particularly as we approach kind of mid and later second trimester.
Yeah.
And similarly, again, maternal bleeding disorders, clotting disorders, uterine and cervical factors, infections, and comorbidities that the pregnant person may have, things like autoimmune disease, diabetes with sugar that is not well controlled, yeah, or severe cardiovascular disease can all be associated with these second trimester losses.
Okay. Okay. So when we kind of cross that line of getting closer to over that 20 week mark where, mm-hmm, it now becomes a stillbirth, mm-hmm, I know that the options for treatment varies a lot,
yeah,
depending on where you are, what facility you're at, mm-hmm, what you would prefer.
Yeah.
What are some options that patients are presented at that time?
So certainly in second trimester, especially in the mid to later weeks of second trimester,
yeah,
inpatient management is often kind of, yeah, the mainstay. So admission, yeah, to hospital for management one way or another. Mm-hmm. While in kind of early to mid second trimester, some surgical options are still open to us.
Yeah.
Sometimes this involves more of what might be akin to an induction protocol to deliver the baby vaginally.
Yeah.
And so I know that both you and I have, yeah, had the privilege to walk with many families through second trimester loss in that manner, yeah, as well.
Yeah, it's something that at least at my facility, we tend to do around, I think it's over 16 weeks gestation. Mm-hmm. We admit patients, and I know that's not everywhere. And I honestly, I need to say this needs to, mm-hmm, be something that is everywhere. Yeah. Like there needs to be a designated unit where people can experience, whether it's miscarriage at 8 weeks or,
yeah,
you know, second trimester loss. It doesn't matter what gestation, you still deserve to be supported in every manner possible.
Yeah.
Cause I know there's a lot of stories online of people, you know, experiencing a miscarriage in the emergency department and sitting there scared and uncomfortable and in pain. And
yeah,
that to me just breaks my heart. Like,
yeah,
I truly think that we do, like, there's a long way we need to go to provide better care for people who are experiencing miscarriage.
Yeah.
But it is a privilege, and it, yeah, is something that I do love that we can provide, at least, yeah, at our facilities, is support for these,
yeah,
people who are experiencing some second trimester miscarriages.
Yeah.
Because I've even been able to grab little handprints and footprints too,
yeah,
for patients to take home with them, some weights and measurements,
yeah,
as well. It is much more challenging when the baby is really, really,
yeah,
little, but sometimes it's something we can do.
So, yeah.
Stuff to keep in mind as well.
I do feel often as a provider, said, I don't know about you. I know you're going to say you feel the same,
yeah,
that like, as much as these deliveries are a lot harder in many ways, mm-hmm, right, for provider, you know, and certainly not to say nothing of for patients.
Yeah.
They are some of the deliveries that I do feel the weight of what we do the most acutely.
Yeah.
And I used the word earlier, privilege, really intentionally.
Yeah.
Because I do think it is a privilege to be able to walk with people through grief,
yeah,
and through loss.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we do what we do, right? Is to be able to provide some sense of comfort, some sense of help, mm-hmm, in some of the darkest moments of, yeah, people's lives. And,
yeah,
so these deliveries are also, you know, ones that we hold close to our hearts. right?
I cherish them and I remember every single one of them, truly. I really do. And I try to support my patients the best that I can through these experiences, whether that's, you know, getting the hand and footprints for them, or writing a little note, or providing them with a little hand knit hat that would fit the baby at that particular size. Just something to make, to acknowledge that this was real and that I was here for them. And I hope that, you know, I was able to provide some relief to those patients, but it's a very difficult circumstance, but something that, again, I'm very privileged to be a part of. We welcome life into this world so often. But it's also a part of our job to support women who are experiencing loss as well.
And pregnancy loss at any gestational age is a loss, right? And the grief associated with that is real, whether and personal, whether the loss was an early, you know, first trimester loss or a later loss. And you know what? I think that's also part of why it is important to talk about, right? Because people experience a lot of isolation in that grief. When we look at evidence, up to 1/3 of women experience significant depression or anxiety associated with miscarriage. And PTSD associated with experiences surrounding miscarriage is not uncommon either. I know that you've seen this, I think, as well sometimes, that in your practice in walking with parents through these roles or through these experiences.
100%. Every time. And I think even, you know, when I talk to people about my job and how I do work with a lot of women who experience pregnancy loss and miscarriage and stillbirth, a lot of people forget that that actually happens because it's such an isolating experience. And you know, people almost feel this sense of, I don't know, like shame in talking about it. When truly it's okay to talk about it and to find those communities for support. I see a lot of that online too, where people can find support groups that they can be a part of that might help them to find like-minded people who might be going through similar situations. But
100%. And this is supported in the evidence too, right? Miscarriage is associated with significant increases in risks of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and complicated grief, right? And I say that not to try and scare anybody who might be, you know, on the precipice of experiencing a miscarriage, but rather I want to normalize that those feelings are
valid
and that they are common. It is established in the literature, right? And you know what is protective against continuing to experience those feelings in a way that inhibits you from, you know, returning to life and moving forward is having support from family, support from friends, support from healthcare providers, right? All of these things, empathetic care, clear information that's provided, as well as community support in and around miscarriage at any gestational age is protective. It's associated with significant reduction in experience of those things in the long term. And so that's part of why, like, our job is so important in making sure that we are clear and intentional and empathetic and compassionate when walking through this with people. But also I think increasingly we need to model those behaviors in our own lives, right? With the women and pregnant people around us.
100%. And if you know someone who experienced a miscarriage, I'll provide a couple of tips that I think would be helpful. Again, you guys comment what you found helpful, what people did around you to best support you during that time. But from what I've experienced going through this with patients, acknowledging the loss is important, and avoid those minimizing phrases like it wasn't meant to be. That is something that a lot of people say, or at least it was early. Those phrases can be very harmful because, as you said earlier, it doesn't matter at any point. Whenever you have experienced your pregnancy loss, it doesn't matter if it's at 8 weeks or if it's at 20 weeks. It is still, loss, and it is, no matter what your feelings are, they are still valid.
Yeah.
So validating emotions and normalizing that all feelings are valid is very important.
Loss is loss, and delivery of a pregnancy, and I use that in a general sense, regardless of the mode of delivery, right? Yeah. Whether this is a third trimester kind of vaginal delivery, which is what we think of, or whether it's a DNC in first trimester in order to evacuate a non-viable pregnancy. This represents a like anytime you experience a delivery and you go home without your child, I think is inherently traumatic and intensely personal.
Exactly. And that's also why it's important to check in with those people, not even just when it happens, but months down the road,
you
know, check in with them, see how they're doing. And if they've like, ask if they've named the baby, sometimes they have, and you know, talk to them, use the name, because that can be very helpful. Obviously, everyone's different. So talk to the person about what they would prefer, but check in on them, make them meals, do all that kind of stuff, because that can be very, very helpful as well.
I think sometimes when people are experiencing grief and loss, regardless of the source, and this is just like common in life, I think we get so scared of saying the wrong thing that we say nothing. Right? And I think a good first step for many people is just to ask people what they need, right? How can I support you? If you get the sense that they want to talk about their baby, right? They want to talk about the pregnancy, then being a person that they can talk to about it without feeling that they're making you uncomfortable, right? Or that you want to move on to happier topics, I think is really valuable for many people.
100%. Okay, so moving on to just quick, some red flags that people might need to acknowledge or go seek medical attention if they have gone home and they know they are going to evacuate the miscarriage on their own, or they've gone home with medications to do it. What are some things that, you know, our listeners should be aware of, which obviously their provider will also tell them, but let's just talk about it as well.
So some of the clear things, some of the things we always counsel people about, number one is very heavy bleeding, right? Bleeding is to be expected in the course of a miscarriage, but you should never be bleeding so much that you are soaking a pad per hour for more than 1 hour, right? Or if you are bleeding so heavily that you're feeling very faint or unwell. Similarly, if you're starting to have signs of infection, right? Foul-smelling discharge, fever, or chills. Or if you're in severe pain, pain that you think is far out of proportion for what you should be experiencing, seek medical care. And I know that even in saying these things, this is just kind of a general framework for for evaluation. But I never want somebody to think that they're overreacting by seeking care, because even as I say that, like, what is severe pain? Right? Miscarriage can be very painful. And I think what people define as severe pain can be very different. So far better to come in, be checked out, have someone reassure you that what you're experiencing is part of the normal process than to sit at home potentially with a concerning, potentially life-threatening issue and not be seeking care.
I think, you know, when you get home, you're going to be Googling, Googling a lot of these symptoms, and you might come across threads of people saying, well, I bled that much too and everything was fine. So just caution on the comparisons because everyone's situation is different, and I would much rather that you go in to be assessed by a professional who knows all your history than to just, you know, play the Google game where, you know, that can be a very dangerous hole that I think we've all probably been in at one point. So try not to do that. And another thing I wanted to mention was, don't be surprised if your particular facility redirects you to the emergency department. I get a lot of calls from patients on labor and delivery specifically who may have had a baby on labor and delivery, so they already have the triage phone number, and they just call that, right? Because that's logically that makes sense. You're you're dealing with a pregnancy related issue. But if it is an early pregnancy loss, we do redirect our patients, at least at my facility and I think at most facilities in Canada, to go get assessed by the emergency department, where the OBGYN who is on call will come and assess you. So just something to note as well.
So listen, I hope if there's any takeaway to this episode, first and foremost, miscarriage is common. And there are both safe medical and surgical options for helping to resolve a miscarriage if medical or surgical help is needed. Yeah. But care should always be individualized, right? Mm-hmm. There are so many factors, and that's why we didn't delve into like, if this, then this with respect to choices, mm-hmm. because really like what is right for one person is not right for another, both medically as well as emotionally, right? And supporting both that physical and that emotional recovery, I think is really essential.
Yeah. And just kind of, you know, continuing that conversation today is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month. So that's why we're here mm-hmm. to talk about it, and just know that it, like, your miscarriage is almost mm-hmm. never caused by something that you did.
Yeah.
So that is something that I think a lot of people place blame on themselves for mm-hmm. Their miscarriage.
You did not cause your miscarriage.
No, we're here to tell you the exact opposite. That is not what happened. And that is why it's important to have these days, these awareness days.
Yeah.
So that you do feel less alone and that you do find a community for support.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you feel comfortable and if you would find it helpful, please join us. Join us in the comments section. Share your experiences.
Yeah.
Send us a DM. Send mm-hmm. us an email at askthepushpod@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Let us know what your experience was, what might have made it better, what made it worse, and how we can continue to support you in this process.
Yeah, we'd love to know. It's something that, again, we said is a privilege for us to be a part of. And if there's anything that I can learn from you guys to take mm-hmm. forward to other patients, to help other people in the future, mm-hmm. that would be so special to yep. us. So if you feel comfortable, share. Make sure you're following us on mm-hmm. Instagram and TikTok at the.push.podcast, mm-hmm. where you can also comment and interact with us and other people. But yeah, that's our episode on miscarriages. Mm-hmm. I hope you found a little bit of help from this episode, yeah. Or at least, you know, got a couple tips and tricks to yeah. help with people in your life who may be mm-hmm. experiencing mm-hmm. this and how you can better help them as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's everything for today.
Thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah, thanks for sticking with us. Tune back next week for another episode of the Push Podcast.
We drop every Wednesday.
Bye.